Next case on the calendar is Core Funding Group versus Diana McDonald. For the appellants, Mr. Rick Marsh.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Rick Marsh of the law firm of Lane, Alton, and Horst here in Columbus. My co-counsel is Paige McMahon of Chillicothe, Ohio, and we do represent the appellant, Willie Gary, and his law firm. Your Honor, I would like to reserve about 2 minutes, if I may, please.
Watch your time.
Your Honors, first of all, I'd like to say that I've had the opportunity and pleasure of appearing before this court in your two prior chambers, and now I have the opportunity to appear here, and this is magnificent, so thank you very much. The facts in this case are very, very simple. A lawyer by the name of Diana McDonald had a good case. She represented a decedent, the estate, she represented a decedent in a value jet plane crash. She needed assistance, and so she obtained a co-counsel, Willie Gary, and they entered into a co-counsel arrangement. The case was ultimately settled. The court ordered fees to attorney's fees and a settlement and fees to be paid out of that. And during that time, during the period of time that this was ongoing, Diana McDonald obtained two loans. We're just going to talk about the one because the one and the other are the same for all practical purposes. Willie Gary was on notice that one loan had been received by Diana McDonald. When the court ordered the distribution of the funds and the
fees.
And
so is that the only one we're going to be talking about is the one that he was on
yes,
notice
sir.
About?
Yes, Your Honor. Willie Gary then forwarded that money, the fee, the 40% of the fee, on to Diana McDonald, and that's why we're here today, because CORE then brought a lawsuit against Willie Gary.
What is the status of her status? Was she sued? Was a judgment obtained against her by
Yes, that's my understanding that she was, Your Honor.
And is she, like, uncollectible? Or
that's
she?
Correct. And so the question is whether or not Willie Gary is liable to CORE under the statutes of Ohio, basically as an account debtor. I know that the court let this in on propositions 2 and 3, and I'm going to try very hard to limit my arguments to propositions 2 and 3, but it seems to me that there is something inherently wrong with a contract that begins by saying, CORE Funding Group LLC, CORE or purchaser, understands that the law offices of Diana McDonald, PC, desires to sell $124,000 worth of a total attorney's fees, which it has previously contracted to receive for legal services rendered by the firm in exchange for a present lump sum cash payment. The contract goes on to say, at paragraph K of the contract, that there's a duty to cooperate and promise to pay. Seller, covenants, agrees and accepts the continuing and irrevocable duty to cooperate with purchaser in providing purchaser the practical benefits of its bargain under the contract, et cetera, et cetera. I have, as a lawyer, I have problems with that kind of an arrangement. And that
so,
kind of agreement.
Although it's not before us, you're suggesting the contract ought to be void as against public policy.
I am suggesting that Willie Gary doesn't want to be a part of that contract. He doesn't want to be, he doesn't feel he should be obligated under it, and if it takes the court a stretch to find that that is unenforceable as to Willie Gary, then yes, Your Honor, that is my response to that.
The problem that your client has is he's working against some securities law, is he not?
That's correct. That's correct. And there's no question that Diana McDonald was specifically loaned this money because of one case and one case only. And she was hopefully going to collect a fee, because she was counsel for the estate of a person killed in an airplane crash. Now, our position is very simple with regard to the account debtor situation. Only the client, with regard to attorney's fees for an attorney, can be the account debtor. It's axiomatic that the only person that owes the attorney his or her fees is the client. Willie Gary did not owe any fees to Diana McDonald. He had a co-counsel agreement with her by which they agreed to, and hopefully it was ethical and legal and so forth, but he agreed to pay her 40% of the fee. And she apparently probably was going to do 40% of the work. But Willie Gary didn't owe her any fees. When this agreement was entered into, there weren't any fees as such. Willie Gary wasn't holding any money.
Is your argument that CORE Funding should have obtained their security arrangement with ValueJet?
No, with the client.
Go with the client?
Absolutely.
But why would not ValueJet be somebody that would be involved? Because they...
I don't think ValueJet, these are attorney's fees. If I'm differentiating between the settlement amount, the wrongful death settlement, and that portion of it, which is the fees.
Okay, the wrongful death settlement would go to the client.
Yes.
The client is then obligated to pay the attorney fees.
Correct.
And so core funding could have put the estate on notice or the client on notice of the assignment.
Core funding could have, but I actually believe that core funding should have gone to the client because the client is the account debtor. The client is the person. And in our reply brief, I wanted to point out one thing that we said in our reply brief.
But I do share your disdain for the overall practice of advancing prospective tort recoveries, period, whether it's to the claimant or the attorney. I guess I was less aware until I saw this case that attorneys were getting in on that as well. But the client generally has no control over the proceeds of a case such as this. The attorneys, the check goes to the attorneys for distribution. And the client, so if you're suggesting the core needed, even if they had advanced funds to the estate, which apparently they didn't do here, is that correct?
Correct.
The person or persons actually dealing with the checks and the distribution of the money is always the attorneys through their trust accounts.
That is true, Your Honor, but in this particular case, the court issued an order, and there was an order of distribution. Now, I don't know that that is determinative of anything, but that's the way it happened in this case. But when there is a settlement, the check is, as you know, the check is going to be made payable to the client and to the lawyer. But it is the client's money. It's the client's cause of action. It's the client's money. The client then has the obligation to pay the attorney's fees. And just because this is a contingent fee doesn't change the fact that the client, out of a settlement or out of any other proceeds, has the obligation to pay the attorney's fees.
Well, if it's the client's money, then the client should have co-signed the loan.
Yes.
But that's illegal under our case law.
Pardon me?
That would be illegal under our case law, under Champerty.
Well, but you see, and that's what we pointed out, is CORE knows that they can't go to the client and get the client to sign it. So they go to Diana McDonald and get her to sign it, and then they try to make Willie Gary a party to this nasty agreement, if you will, and we're saying, no, Willie Gary is not bound by this. Willie Gary is not an account debtor.
But was there something in the record, I seem to recall, that there was a notice of the assignment sent to Willie Gary,
yes,
your
it was.
Client?
As to one of the loans.
I think CORE sent that notice to him, and isn't there argument, therefore, that your client was on notice about this arrangement and therefore should not have made the full payment because there was notice of some obligation out of those funds?
Yes, Your Honor, that is absolutely correct.
Could you address that?
Our position is it doesn't make any difference because he's not an account debtor. It doesn't make any difference whether he's on notice or not.
Is there any obligation he had to protect CORE's interest against McDonald? Is there anything that any case law or regulations that would impose that responsibility on Mr. Carey?
Not to my knowledge. He obviously has an obligation to, and this is our point, is that McDonald and Willie Gary now share, because of the co-counsel arrangement, they have a trust or fiduciary relationship to each other with regard to these attorney's fees. These attorney's fees are sent to Willie Gary. He has them. They are attorney's fees. They constitute part of the client's money, and then part, he's going to take his share and she's going to take her share. He obviously has an obligation to Diana McDonald to pay her share of the attorney's fees. but he's not an account debtor, and and the Corps should not be able to become a party to this trust relationship. Everybody cited the case of Marietta versus Roslovic. And the court below put Willie Gary in the position of Roslovic. They said, you're an account debtor. Roslovic, you were an account debtor. In the Roslovic case, Roslovic is a general contractor. General contractor contracts or subcontracts, however you want to put it, with the subcontractor. Subcontractor, in order to do the job, has to go to the bank. They have to get money in order to fund their, be able to do the job. So the job is done. The general contractor, Roslovic, is on notice of this arrangement with the bank and pays the subcontractor. Subcontractor doesn't pay the bank. At all times, Roslovic was the account debtor. Counsel for the appellee points out that, tries to say that this is no different than my law firm having a line of credit. Of course we have a line of credit. It encompasses my chair, my desk, all the assets of the firm. If Lane Alton and Horst has a client, and the client pays us a fee, that's an entirely different situation than what we have here. Willie Gary is simply not an account debtor. And furthermore, our position is that this does arise from tort. In other words, the Court of Appeals said, well, it just happened that the underlying cause of action was a tort claim. I think that's determinative of it. It was a tort claim, and as a result, it's not subject to Article 9. It's not subject to the UCC, even if you find that Willie Gary was an account debtor. But he's not, and he should not be held to be an account debtor.
So basically, statutes. Counsel, you would equate this as McDonald's debt that would be no different than if she owed a mortgage company for her mortgage, and the mortgage company sent Mr. Gary, a letter saying, hey, she's in the rears on her mortgage, protect us, pay us. Am I basically summarizing how you would want us to look at this?
The analogy is accurate, that it doesn't make any difference. He wouldn't be obligated to pay her mortgage.
Correct. She took the loan out before her arrangement with him. Am I correct on the timing?
The timing is, and those are two of the notes I have, the loan was taken out, I have to tell you, the loan was taken out after the co-counsel agreement. The co-counsel agreement was July 14 of 98. The core funding agreement was 4/29/99.
And they argue or suggest that the purpose of such advancements is to assist lawyers in underwriting the costs, which can be large, in pursuing complex litigation. That's their argument, is that
that's really
their reason for being and their legitimate purpose in life.
And that's why Diana Donald got Willie Gary, because of expertise and the ability to handle this kind of case. Willie Gary didn't need the loan, but Diana McDonald did.
And she did not front any of the costs of this litigation?
Judge Pryor, I can't respond to that because I don't know, but my guess would be that that's correct.
Would that make a difference?
I don't think so.
If they were already co-counsel contractually, and that she obtains a loan to assist in fronting some of the costs of this litigation in which they're co-counsel, why wouldn't that make a difference?
Factually, it does, because now the money that she obtained from CORE has gone into this case.
Yes.
And I would agree with that it ties it tighter to the case. But
we don't know the answer to that question.
I do not know the answer to that question.
Well, you said that Mr. Gary did not front any money here.
Well, I'm sure that Mr. Gary did. I'm saying Willie Gary didn't need a loan. Diana McDonald's, my understanding, was sort of a storefront lawyer. She got this case. She didn't know what to do with it. She goes to Willie Gary, who's handled lots of these things. It's my understanding that Willie Gary has two airplanes, Wings of Justice 1 and Wings of Justice 2.
Is the better wing, do you know?
It's a different lifestyle. But it's my understanding that Willie Gary fronted the funds that were necessary, and of course the case was settled. But I'm just going to sum up by indicating that under the UCC, the funds are the Willie Gary is not an account debtor. The account debtor, if you will, is the client. The client owes the fees to Willie, and furthermore, it does arise from tort. Unless the court has any further questions, I appreciate your interest in this case. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Marsh. And representing the appellee core funding group is Mr. Jeffrey Morris. Mr. Morris.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Justice Pfeiffer, members of the court, this actually is just about the Uniform Commercial Code. In fact, relatively straightforward application of the UCC and just a few sections. The question first and foremost that this court has asked the parties to address is Mr. Gary and is his law firm an account debtor? The way to determine that is to take a look at section 130901A1. That's the definition in the Uniform Commercial Code. An account debtor is any person that owes an obligation on an account, chattel paper, or an instrument. Or a general intangible. Now, this clearly doesn't involve chattel paper, so we can take that out of the definition. So we're left with an account debtor is a person who owes an obligation on either an account or a general intangible. Now, does Mr. Gary owe an obligation to Ms. McDonald? Of course he does. They recognize that. Mr. Gary himself, and in the briefs, clearly the appellant says they inadvertently paid Ms. McDonald. Well, I assume that means they did it by mistake. They thought they were supposed to send money elsewhere. And the reason they thought that, of course, is because they had been notified, particularly by Core Funding, that the money should be paid over to Core Funding.
Now, let me play devil's advocate, because your assumption of account debtor, I'm having some trouble with, because the settlement is the client's.
Yes, Your Honor.
The client has two attorneys representing her. The client owes 60% of the fees to one attorney, 40% to another. The law firm is, Willie is just the conduit. He doesn't owe it to the other party. It's the client that owes it to McDonald. So I'm having trouble with your account debtor obligations, because to me the debt is not from him to her. He may have gotten the check, but the check probably has all three names on it. And so he simply putting it in an account and distributing the sums, but it's not his debt owed to her, it's the client that owes her the attorney fees.
But I think as was clear in the earlier argument, Your Honor, the check comes to the attorney. The attorney then withholds their portion of the fee and sends the remainder, the bulk, to the client.
But that's just a bookkeeping issue. When all three names are on the check, client and two attorneys, it's not a debt that one attorney owes to another, it's the debt the client owes to both attorneys. And one has to cash the check and distribute it. If the check had gone to McDonald, and McDonald had sent Gilly his share, would McDonald have been the account debtor?
No, Your Honor, not because Gary was not a debtor at all under the transaction. You see, what happens, Your Honor, is the client does owe this obligation to the lawyers. However, the lawyers owe an obligation to each other by virtue of their co-counsel agreement. And that's agreed, and that's certainly the law from this court.
Let me go back and say if the check had gone, instead of going to Willie, had gone to McDonald, three same names on it.
Yes, Your Honor.
And McDonald had run it through her trust account, where would you be?
We'd be in big trouble, Your Honor. She would have taken the money and not paid us. We would have had no cause of action against Mr. Gary because he never would have been.
And then why does that make him an account debtor when he never handles the check, the client owes the attorney fees, she gets the check and sends it to him? How does that make him an account debtor?
Those aren't the facts of this case, Your Honor. He would not be an account debtor in that circumstance, but the fact that he got the money is what generates his status as an account debtor.
Okay, so just because somebody is the bookkeeper to distribute funds makes him an account debtor?
He's greatly more than a bookkeeper, Your Honor. He's also a party to a contract with Ms. McDonald, which creates a contractual obligation that he has to her to turn over the funds that he might receive. Certainly, if she had received the money, she could not have held on to the full, say, $500,000 of fees and not paid him.
Okay, she's the first attorney, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the client hire Willie or does she hire Willie?
Well, the client agrees to the co-counsel agreement and, in fact, signed that agreement along with both attorneys.
She, in essence, went out and found Willie for the client.
That's my understanding, Your Honor, with the approval of her client.
So, again, how does that make him her debtor when she went out and hired him?
He becomes her debtor because he agreed with Ms. McDonald to turn money over to her should he get it, just as she agreed to turn it over to him if she got it. So the obligation arose when he got the money. He now had an obligation to pay her. For example, no matter which attorney had gotten the money first, the other could have sued that attorney and said, you have to turn that over to me, and they would have had a good cause of action. In fact, appellant recognizes that this trust relationship arose between the two attorneys. Well, the beneficiary of a trust has a cause of action against the trustee to live up to the terms of the trust, to turn over the asset to the beneficiary that has a right to receive it. Similarly here, if Gary has the money, he can't just keep the whole fee and ignore the co-counsel agreement. He has an obligation to turn that portion, 40%, over to Ms. McDonald. That was the agreement they had. As a result, he has an obligation to her. That obligation either is to pay an account or a general intangible. The definition of general intangible is any personal property, including chose as an action, a right in action, and she certainly has a cause of action against him if he takes the full fee and puts it in his pocket. There's no question but that she could say, you have to turn over my 40% pursuant to our agreement.
Well, simple when she did do that, when he did do that, that's the end of their trust relationship.
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
He has met his obligation to her, executed the responsibilities of any trust, if you say there was a trust relationship there, and they go their separate ways. So how does he end up being on the hook for a loan that she took out in her name only, that the lender only had her sign, even though they were aware of a co-counsel, and in essence, it was unsecured by anything other than a contingency fee, her 40% of the contingency fee.
Actually, it was secured by any receivables that she had, Your Honor. In any case, it specifically identified
these. She was only
entitled
to 40% of the contingency fee.
Correct,
so that's
Your Honor.
All she could offer or all you could hope to attach.
Out of that particular case, she could have had other cases, too. But Your Honor, your question is, well, what generates this obligation that Gary has to core funding? Well, that's section 1309.37C, statute that's been around forever. It requires an account debtor who is notified of the assignment of the account to pay the assignee. And in fact, the UCC provides greater protection than it would have had at common law, because they could say, if we're not sure, if it's unclear to us that this has been assigned, they can demand proof of the assignment.
So the essential issue we have is whether we agree with you that a trust relationship and a co-counsel creates an account debtor versus it does not because the client is the account debtor.
That could be true, Your Honor, except that I think both sides agree that there is a trust relationship, and both sides therefore have to agree that Gary had an obligation to McDonald, just as McDonald did to Gary.
Had an obligation under a trust arrangement.
Yes.
But not necessarily an account debtor unless we accept your interpretation of the statute.
Well, again, the definition of general intangible is any right, any personal property of any kind. And certainly her right against Gary, just as his against her, is a right of personal property. You can pursue a claim against him if he breaches that agreement. So any cause of action that you would have, failure to pay for goods sold or leased, services rendered whether or not earned by performance, an account, or any other kind of cause of action as a general intangible, creates an account debtor. That's the definitional system. 1309A1 as definition of account debtor, and the 1309A16 and the definition of general intangible in tandem leave no other option.
So under your theory, if she was behind on her mortgage, the mortgage could have sent Willie Gary a notice and also...
No, Your Honor. Here's why that doesn't work. The mortgage company would have a lien on her real estate. That's the only collateral they have. Here, Core Funding's collateral is the right to receive a payment from anybody, including from Gary. And so, since that's your right, the way that a creditor can pursue or recognize that collateral is by notifying that person, pay me instead of the person to whom you directly owe. And that notification under 1309.37.
Counsel, should the notice have gone to the defendants?
No, Your Honor. The defendants had no obligation to pay until it was a settlement, although they could have sent one there. I don't think it would have been an appropriate one because, again, the defendant's obligation would have been to pay the plaintiff. And we had no lien on any right of the plaintiff.
Well, but they always make the check out to the plaintiff and their lawyers, so the lawyers are protected. So if you notify the defendant, then the defendant presumably would have put CORE on the check along with the two lawyers.
Could have, Your Honor, except that, again, the defendant does not owe the lawyer the money. They may put the lawyer's name on there for convenience purposes, but they don't owe the lawyer the money.
Well, they always do. I mean,
yes, Your Honor, and that's why we knew that Gary's name would be on that check, that he would have control of those funds, and so we said, rather than let those funds be funneled ultimately to McDonald, we should have a right to receive notice, to receive that payment.
Let me back you up so that I'm certain as to the facts. In paragraph 4 of the Court of Appeals opinion, they say, on May 12, 1999, Willie Gary, a Florida attorney for the Gary Law Firm, executed an acknowledgement of assignment which set forth the first $124,000 due to the McDonald appellees with regards to the ValueJet case was assigned. So there is no dispute that there was a signed acknowledgement of assignment on the first $124,000.
Correct, Your Honor.
There was not on the second $75,000.
There was not a signed one, but there was a notification given to Gary.
So
there's no obligation.
We decide this case affects both?
Yes, Your Honor, they're really the same because 1309.37C doesn't require any execution of acknowledgement. It simply requires notification.
I think that was going to be my question. There really isn't any consideration for the by Gary for executing this acknowledgement.
No, and nor is there any need for it, Your Honor.
Okay.
This is not.
So it's immaterial.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. This is just like any situation where a lender makes a loan secured by a debtor's accounts receivable. The way that you're going to collect is by notifying the people who owe the debtor the money to send it over to you. The lender has made no transaction with those account debtors. Simply notifies them to send the money to the creditor.
Mr. Marsh indicates that it makes a difference that this is about a tort.
Yes, Your Honor. He makes that point, but it really isn't about a tort at all. This is about the relationship between the two lawyers whose relationship arose by virtue of a contract between the two. There's no attempt by CORE Funding to obtain any interest in the cause of action whatsoever. This is a loan to Diana McDonald. We don't know what she used the money for. She could have used it for any purpose. It was not a restriction to the use of this money. It was a loan to a lawyer, just like, as Mr. Marsh noted.
Loan to a lawyer based upon a case that we lawyers would agree is pretty much a slam dunk. Given the facts that were made public shortly after the ValueJet crash.
Sure.
It's a good case.
Sounded like
a great
it, Your
case. Honor. Case you'd like to have.
Well, yeah. You know, if you can help the decedent, that would be a good thing.
Yeah. In addition to it being a tort, the question that I pursued with Mr. Marsh is, does it matter, does it improve your case if, in fact, Diana McDonald used some of the funds to underwrite costs of this litigation?
I think it's irrelevant, Your Honor. It doesn't matter what the use of the funds were. Clearly, a loan was made by CORE to McDonald. That debtor-creditor relationship was established.
So if none of the funds went to underwrite the costs of bringing this litigation or to assist in that regard?
Same result, Your Honor. Absolutely. This is simply
CORE
a loan.
Wins.
Just like Mr. Marsh noted, his law firm has a line of credit. Well, their receivables
your
are, in
whole
fact,
case is the UCC controls.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Open
there's,
shut.
There's no exception. The 130904 exceptions in relating to liens for lawyers' fees. This is not a lien for lawyers' fee as against the client. This is, in fact, a lien on a lawyer's right to receive a payment pursuant to their co-counsel agreement. Likewise, this is not any assignment of an employee's interest in wages, that sort of thing, just has nothing to do with that. This is just a right to receive a payment under this contract. That's an account that is received.
Before your time runs out, let me ask you whether or not there's evidence in the record that CORE sent notice of both loans to your client.
Yes, Your Honor. The first is the signed acknowledgement. The second is a fax and fax cover sheet, which the Court of Appeals noted no one could dispute was sent. Mr. Gary's affidavit says, very carefully worded, Your Honor, I did not receive this. Well, it was sent to his law firm. Whether he, and it's clear that it was received by his law firm, so notice was given, notification was provided. The absence of a signature really isn't significant. There was no need for any signature. The fact that it was on the first one is more a matter of extra care and caution in being able to show that there was no question but that these notices have been received.
Is there any case authority that lets us make this application of this fee-sharing arrangement between Gary and McDonald subject to the UCC? Do you have any?
Well, Your Honor, there are a couple of cases. One is the Berg case that's in the both briefs and was in the Court of Appeals, a case from Delaware. There is more recently a First Circuit case, Schlickman versus Cadel. The citation escapes me. I can certainly provide it, but it was a case involving the lawyer who was made famous by the book A Civil Action and the movie. He had granted a security interest in his receivables to a bank, and the court recognized that as a fully enforceable. It was not a co-counsel arrangement. Those dealt with breakups of law firms and the claims of
nothing
former partners.
With respect to the payment of a fee from a client to a lawyer in a shared arrangement subject to the UCC.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the beginning, Your Honor.
Nothing subject to the fee generation from a client subject to the UCC as be shared between lawyers.
Well, in fact, Your Honor, I don't think that's what this case is about, but that's what those other cases recognized, was that there was an ability of a lawyer to grant a security interest in those amounts. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Now, further, I think, Your Honor, that clearly the simple, straightforward application of the UCC is really the solution to this problem.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Marsh, as our custom, even though your time's expired, we give you a minute to respond.
Thank you, Your Honors. As a defense attorney representing people in the defendants, I don't usually get the last word, but it's very nice. Two very, very brief points. One, it appears that CORE is now arguing that whether or not Willie Gary's an account debtor all depends upon how the check is made payable and to whom it goes. And that shouldn't be. If in this case the trial judge, the judge who was handling the case, had been aware of the fee sharing agreement, had been aware of the loan, and the judge had sent the check directly to Diana McDonald, can we sue the judge? He was on notice of it. Once, what happens when this case is tried and lost? Does Willie Gary owe any money to anybody, to Diana McDonald? No, he does not. He doesn't owe her a fee, nor is he obligated to pay her mortgage. Thank you.
Counsel, I just have a housekeeping matter. I know that everyone's referring to former Chapter 1309, the secured transactions, which has been repealed as of 2001. Just to help us out, what is the new citation or what has happened to that entire chapter?
It became... It was repealed effectively, yes, and was reenacted under different sections. They are now 1309-406A and 309-109.
Thank you.
I see Mr. Morris nodding his head, so I take it there is agreement as to the...
Thank you. We agree on that.
...status. Thank you, Mr. Marsh and Mr. Morris. The case is submitted, and you will be advised in due time as to the outcome.